This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, hello. I'd like to welcome you to this panel on transparency. The personnel of our panel has changed slightly since the program was printed. So I think what I'll do, probably the best way to proceed, is to allow the panelists to introduce themselves in a moment. Let me just say a little bit by way of introduction. My name is Fauna Foreman. I'm an associate professor of political science here at the university, and I co-direct the UC San Diego Center on Global Justice, which is a hub on the campus for research and teaching on poverty and economic development across the world. Really, we have projects in Africa, South Asia, Latin America. But we've also committed ourselves in recent years to what we think of as localizing the global, focusing on projects right here in the San Diego-Tijuana border region. One area of research and action that's been essential to us, thinking about work in marginalized and traditionally underserved communities in our city, is how to cultivate civic engagement, how to combat a sort of deep sense of political alienation and hopelessness that can happen to a community at a cultural level when it perceives itself as outside a city's moral concern, outside of the vision of urban development in a city or in a region. So we've been invested in how these communities can begin to develop a new sense of political agency and capacity, and how government can escalate, at escalating scales, can become more responsive to these emerging, and in the case of San Diego, demographically ascending democratic voices. Anyway, it's a joy to be here today to moderate this panel on transparency, what is arguably the baseline of any legitimate democratic system of governance at any scale, and essential to giving content to the idea of the consent of the governed in a democratic society. Thanks so much to our Chancellor, Pradeep, and his office for recognizing the importance of citizenship culture, particularly among our young people today, and the role of a public university in opening conversation and debate about these things. And I'm also delighted to be here today with my colleagues from the Department of Political Science to help structure the conversation, and hopefully as well to shine some light on the fantastic work that we're doing here at UC San Diego to understand and to improve democratic institutions and democratic culture here in San Diego, across California, the U.S., and indeed across the globe in societies that are transitioning to democratic, transparent, and participatory forms of governance. So let me begin right now. We could maybe go down the row and allow our panelists to introduce themselves, and then I'll say a little bit more about how I would very lightly like to structure the conversation today while giving as much latitude to directions that our panelists would like to go, and as well involving energies from the audience. So why don't we begin at the end, and we can just move through.
My name is Don Wilcox. I am almost 20-year staffer in the legislature. I've worked in both houses, the Assembly and the Senate, for leadership and then for individual members.
My name is Sam Schuchat. I'm the executive officer of the California State Coastal Conservancy. We are the non-regulatory coastal agency for California. We acquire land and build trails and restore wetlands and do that sort of thing throughout coastal California from San Diego to the Oregon border. So I am your token executive branch bureaucrat on the panel.
I'm Brian Jones. I'm an assembly member here from San Diego County. I represent the eastern half of San Diego County from the Mexico border up through the mountains and into Idlewild, so southern Riverside County. I have landmass-wise, I have one of the largest districts in Southern California. And prior to that, I was on the Santee City Council for 8 years. And while I was – that's a part-time position. My profession with that, I was a commercial real estate agent.
I'm Daryl Steinberg. I'm the senator representing Sacramento. As of today, for the first day in 6 years, I'm no longer the president pro tem of the Senate. I served in that position for the 6 years previously, but my successor was sworn in last night. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. I'm Brian Mainshine. I'm an assembly member for the 77th District, which is essentially the northern part of the city of San Diego. Prior to that, I was the San Diego County Commissioner on Homelessness. And before that, I was a two-term San Diego City Council member. And thank you for having me here this morning.
Hello, my name is Kyle Haskala. I'm a fourth-year environmental systems student here at UC San Diego.
Fantastic. And I should say I'm particularly excited to have student representation on this panel. Kyle was instrumental in developing a project here on the campus, which led to the development of a project called By the People, which is an online voting platform that presently allows voters in North County San Diego to directly lobby their elected officials through weekly polls. This platform is designed in collaboration with the Union Tribune and funded by the National Science Foundation through the Jacobs School of Engineering, and really has a potential for UCSD research to be expanded as a model to other cities to change the way citizens communicate with their elected officials. So this is super exciting to have somebody here who represents a kind of entrepreneurial democratic sensibility in a demographic that many of us have kind of assumed exemplifies political apathy and the sort of political distance of our society today. So, great. Well, welcome to all of you. As I said a moment ago, I want to provide some structure to our conversation, but I don't want to overly determine the direction that we go. But I thought we might begin by thinking of transparency as central to three elements that are essential to democratic society and a healthy democratic set of institutions. The first we might think of as democratic accountability, the question of accountability. Transparency understood as enabling us to hold our leaders accountable for the decisions they make, for the money they take, the allocations and resources that they make, and so forth. So a transparent government is the baseline of democracy in this sense, because it allows us to give content to the idea that we're consenting to the governors. Okay, so accountability is the first element. The second we might think of as democratic accessibility. So if accountability is holding our leaders to task, accessibility refers to the means, the techniques by which the decisions and actions of government are made transparent to citizens, how we gain access to information and data, and how this is transformed then into public knowledge. So the platform, the strategies. And third, finally, after accountability and accessibility, is what we might think of as democratic agency. How information translates into democratic voice and action among the citizens. Transparency obviously means nothing if citizens don't understand how or have the capacity, the agency, to make use of political information, the data they have access to, and to exercise their citizenship to produce real change. This is certainly true across socioeconomic classes, but it may be particularly true among traditionally underserved and marginalized demographics throughout our society. So, accountability, accessibility, agency. I'd like to offer some provocations on each of these in turn to get us started. And then we can turn to the audience in the second half to open things up. So let me begin with the question of agency as transparency as accountability, what we might think of as the foundation of any legitimate democratic set of institutions, that leaders are accountable to the governed for the decisions they make in the name of the public good, that being elected in a democratic society is a trust between the governors and the governed that can be revoked if the trust is broken or if the majority no longer believe that their governors are representing the collective will. So I'd like to begin this way and pose the question to each one of you as a way of further introducing the sort of work that you do. In the particular realms of politics and civil society in which you work and move, what does accountability mean to you? More specifically, what dimensions of governance and public life do you believe in your realm of work need to be more transparent than they presently are? So we can begin. In either direction. Would you like to start us?
Well, I would say that with technology, we're a lot more accountable and a lot more transparent than we've ever been in the past. Instantaneously, you know how people have voted. Instantaneously, or within 24 hours, close to an election, you know what kind of contributions have come in and late contributions. So technology has really changed how we interface. Unfortunately, when we have all this accessibility and things are really out in the open like they've never been before, we have a disconnect where people have lost interest. And so I think that the real challenge is how do we work with technology to invigorate that base again and have people take the interest to see that there really is a lot more transparency and openness in government than there ever has been in the past. And I would say that, you know, in the legislature, we have bill tracking on subject matter, bill tracking on word. You can search just about any dynamic to come up with, a base that you can follow and interact with. And it's really unprecedented. And that's all through technology. I think that we've come a long way, to be quite frank.
So what does accountability mean to me? Thankfully, I am not an elected official, although many of my best friends are. So I'm not going to talk about, you know, that side of it. What we try to do at the Coastal Conservancy is lay out for the public what we want to accomplish with over the next 5 years with the resources that we have in a strategic plan that is debated and adopted in public. And then we bring projects and initiatives to our board, which meets in public. And then we report on the outcomes of those projects and initiatives to the legislature, to the administration. And we put pretty much all of this on the web in various forms. And now we've started moving into social media, and we have a Facebook page. Actually, we have two Facebook pages. Sometimes I think my parents are the most avid consumers of those, but I think it's growing slowly. I think the challenges we face, or a few of the challenges that we face, it's not always easy to translate the technical language of government into plain English that people can understand. One of the shocks for me, because I ran nonprofits before I came into government 14 years ago, government accounting has nothing whatsoever to do with private sector accounting. And if you're used to private sector accounting and principles, and then you want to look at the budget or read a financial report, feels like you've entered into Never Never Land. And I have to say, after 14 years, I am still encountering new terminology and new concepts. And I think the other challenge for us is sometimes I wonder, as we're pushing all of this stuff out onto the web, how interested people really are. I mean, I kind of would like it if my phone would ring more often and people would pay more attention to what we were doing. Of course, my phone doesn't ring very much anymore because nobody calls anymore. They use email now. That's a change that's happened in the course of my career. But I think finding ways to get people to be interested in what we do, which I think is really interesting, is a challenge for us.
Thank you.
I think what I can share is maybe one of my frustrations after getting elected to the legislature is that when we're talking about accountability and transparency, we usually camp on the whole idea of the elected official or the candidate, and we forget that there's a whole myriad of layers of government, from bureaucracies to agencies to tax collection, parts of the government that we just kind of ignore and let them to some degree run amok because they're not held accountable. And, you know, recognizing that as a legislator, one of my responsibilities to the people that elected me is holding these departments and department heads accountable for the decisions they make when they pass regulations or when they come up with licensing schemes or tax fee collection schemes that impact the people that are voting. And there just doesn't seem to be a taste in the legislature as a whole in California to hold these departments accountable for the decisions they make. For example, California Air Resources Board is implementing AB 32 that was passed in 2006 by the legislature. Well, the legislature abdicated its oversight responsibility and turned that entirely over to CARB and let them develop and come up with regulations that they think are appropriate that are having a major impact on our businesses and to some degree causing some businesses to make the decision to move out of state. And the legislature, when I ask, you know, why aren't we pulling, you know, let's have a discussion with the regulators and why are you passing this regulation? Why is this necessary? It's impacting the citizens of California. And it's, you know, so it's one of my frustrations to hold the departments accountable as well.
Thank you. Please.
Accountability is, of course, very important when it comes to the process by which government makes its decisions. But I put an even higher value on a different form of accountability. And that is accountability for results, what I call production. Because the process itself is messy. And in fact, it is often imperfect. That's not an excuse for what sometimes comes across as a lack of transparency, but there can be a real conflict at times between substantive progress and process transparency. I'll give you an example. There have been a number of efforts during my years in the legislature to pass a law that says that any bill introduced in the legislature has to be in print for 72 hours before it can be voted upon. Now, on its face, that's a very reasonable and logical thing and consistent with the kind of transparency that we all support. But I want to be provocative here for a moment and tell you that it's not that easy. In February of 2009, my first month as the leader of the Senate, the state faced a $42 billion budget deficit, the worst in state history. We were on the verge, literally, of an economic collapse. And if the four legislative leaders and the governor did not produce a product that was passable, that dented the deficit and assured the bond markets that we were at least beginning the process towards fiscal stability, the economic crisis in California would have been much worse than it already was. We negotiated for 6 weeks, the two Republican leaders, myself, the Speaker of the Assembly, and Governor Schwarzenegger, and we knew that if we ever put that document out to light for public scrutiny for 48 hours or 72 hours, that it would never pass because the cuts were too deep, the tax increases were too controversial, And the interest groups would have picked it apart in such a way that the rank and file would have rebelled, and we never would have passed a budget. So we made a very conscious and controversial choice to keep our negotiations secret until about 12 hours before the vote. And then we passed the budget. And the passage of the February 2009 budget, imperfect as it was the beginning of the denting of the budget deficit in California. And today we have, of course, a surplus. Now, did we do the right thing? I don't know. I think we did. But my point here, in attempting to be a little provocative, is that accountability is more than just process transparency. For if we had failed to pass a budget, the criticism that was leveled against us for not being more process transparent would have been multiplied, in my view, 100-fold, because we failed to do the people's business and people would suffer. This is an imperfect system. And anybody who is cynical or walks away because of its imperfections is sort of missing the point. Thank you.
That's fantastic. It actually previews a question I wanted to follow up with later, but we'll hold off and we'll do it in a moment. But the question of transparency itself, whether there can be too much. And this is a part of classical democratic theory that sometimes the governed need to be kept in the dark just long enough for their government to act in their interest, that sometimes their interest is compromised by too much information. But we'll get there in a moment. Let's move forward.
Well, in terms of accountability, at least to begin with, from an elected official standpoint, the good news, I think, for the public is an elected official is accountable every 2 years or 4 years. And we have an opportunity to vote on the people who are governing us. And so there is that accountability each time. In addition, elected officials are their votes are immediately reported on, not just in the traditional news media, but instantaneously by the government. And then, of course, in terms of commentary, by whether it's an individual blogger or up to a CNN or a Fox News. I think that's the good side. I think, in addition, we probably at no time in our history have had easier access to more information than we do now. The result of it on some level is there is information overload, I think, for a lot of people. And I think, too, for the public, while, to the people in the room, by virtue of you being here, these issues are important to you, obviously. You're interested in them. The people up here are doing this professionally. And so it's important, obviously, to us. But I think for a large percentage of the population, they've got to get dinner on the table. They've got to get to soccer practice. They've got a lot of things they have to do, and they don't follow it day to day. So the information is there. They're either unable, unwilling, uninterested. There's a whole lot of reasons, good, bad, and indifferent, why the public doesn't always follow what's going on. I think the best, the shortest, and easiest route would be to have a more engaged public. And if the public did that and saw how their elected officials were voting, really understood, I think oftentimes we'd see different results. I think if you look at the impact of money in politics, I think by and large, and while there's First Amendment issues and there's a whole lot of issues there, if you look at what ends up happening after the national political parties spend millions and millions of dollars trashing one another, it ends up, a lot of people, I think, do just think a pox on all their houses and lose interest in voting. All these people, of course, if anybody spends millions of dollars saying what a jerk you are, public's going to start believing that. And so that's the unfortunate thing. And I think we see it because there are both nationally and statewide so few really contested seats. You see what ends up happening. We have a congressional race here. I'm sure many people are familiar with where the national parties have come in and essentially, really taken over and pounding millions and millions of dollars in television. And you can't watch a ball game without being subjected to these horrendous ads. And of course, people at the end of those are going to think the people running are both jerks and why should I vote? Why should I be interested? So I do think that that's kind of the overlay that exists there. But at the core of it, I do think we have a lot more transparency than we did before because of the internet, because of the efforts that have been made by a lot of the people sitting up here to make government more transparent. But at the same time, the public has to be willing to want to seek that out and have the ability to seek that out.
Thank you.
So my name is not in the packet or the folder, but the person that I'm replacing, I worked very closely with in the student panelist that was up here previously was in an organization called SOVAC. So the three of us have a kind of a common work that we work on, and it is voter engagement. And the project that was mentioned by the people, I worked with Arsha on a similar project here that was put forward for students because we see the university as a microcosm. It represents a smaller kind of city in a way. And there's different levels of student government here. There's college councils. We have six colleges here. And then there's the student government that is the associated students. And so him and I came to each other one day and we said, I have an idea. We both had the idea at the same time. We wanted to create a tool online that could bring students into the process because it's very it's interesting to see student leaders be elected, then go and sit in a room in the student government chambers for an entire year, and you never hear from them. They'll work on their issues, and they'll come to you when it's needed, but we have 21,000 undergraduates. And out of that, maybe about 50 are doing the work and making the decisions. So the tool that we developed allowed students to see what the student government was going to be voting on, discussing online in real time, and give their feedback on it, a yes, no, or abstain. And that was an attempt to bring thousands of more opinions into the room than was physically possible. So transparency, in a sense, doesn't go far enough because you need the engagement. So I really appreciate the way that this discussion's been set up. So allowing students to see what the government is doing in real time allows them to become more engaged in the process. So we were really proud of the work that we did there, and we were able to get thousands of respondents on various issues that we otherwise would not have been able to achieve. So that work kind of led to the formation of By the People, which is in its concept similar, that we want to bring the public into the process, not just tell them what's going on, but give them the opportunity to actively participate in that process.
Thank you. That's great. It's wonderful to have you here because one of the driving questions for us in this symposium is student engagement, which brings, I've been teaching here now for about 12 years. And the moment when I saw students become just a little bit more engaged and a little bit more curious was when the state budget was about to impact their tuition. Amazing how that happens, right? And so suddenly there was interest, there was a little bit of a spark, it died down very quickly. And I showed students in a very large introductory political science course that I was teaching films of the way students would have responded maybe 30 years or 40 years ago in the state of California if the state was tinkering with their tuition. But there seems to be kind of a slow uptake of, political consciousness, even on issues where students are really invested in the decisions that are made. So it raises the issue, I think, about not only transparency in government at various scales, but also transparency in the institutions that govern our lives in all sorts of ways, the universities that we work in, the corporations that we work for, and so forth. So this is an open question as well, whether transparency means more than simply open government, if it means open institutions more generally across civil society. But what I'd like to do now is turn the conversation, a theme that emerged throughout here really was the fact that we do have access to more information than we ever have before through platforms and technologies and so forth. But I'd like to to raise a question about this, whether technology alone, obviously technology and these platforms serve as a kind of bridge between, you know, accountability on the one hand and civic engagement on the other. So we have to have the platforms, but is technology really the whole answer here? As Brian pointed out, young people are immersed in technology and social media, so there's a kind of overload phenomenon. There's also huge complexity. This issue came across at many points here. How the citizen navigates this complexity, who has the time, who has the skills to do it. So does the burden fall on government then? To improve public communication, to make this information more digestible somehow? Or is the burden on civil society to demand it and to create institutions within civil society to help translate complexity into public knowledge? Is the news media the answer? Do we surrender too much to them when we allow them to parse the data and feed it to us in their no-spin zones? Or are there other ways? So this is the question I'd like to open up. The possibility of other institutions, other mechanisms that should be tasked in a healthy democratic society with increasing public knowledge. What, for example, is the role of the public university in producing civically engaged democratic citizens who know more about the rules that govern their lives? You know, maybe Ari can start out here because he's been involved in the development of these kinds of platforms. Do you think technology is the answer? What kinds of institutions should we be imagining? What kinds of cross-sector collaborations should we be imagining to increase public knowledge today, given the overload, given the technology?
So I do think that the information overload is a real problem because we hear about worldwide problems. We hear about problems on all scales. But then the question is that I think individuals feel overwhelmed and like they can't have an impact. It's how, what can I do about it? So that's where students can feel disengaged in whatever decisions are being made. So you mentioned that when the state was looking at increasing tuition, students were outraged because our cost of education was going to go up dramatically. But then we realized, as soon as you know, students went out and they were protesting or whatever, they realized that there's these large, complicated systems in place that are not easily moved or swayed in an instant. Where there's an aspect of like instant gratification that people have in sort of like, if you want to find the answer for something, you Google it. If you want to stop tuition raises, you can't Google it. You know, you have to, it takes a long time. It's a large, arduous process. So figuring out a way to get people engaged all the time, not just when it impacts them, I think is really going to solve the issue so that it's not when there's a crisis or when there's a problem, but if it's day-to-day an option where people can have an impact in the processes, making that easier so that comments can be organized on a larger scale and consolidated electronically rather than, you know, driving in person to a committee meeting somewhere downtown in person. That, I mean, that becomes difficult in this day and age. Everything is faster. Everything is, asking for our attention. So if we can give people an opportunity to actually influence the outcome or feel like they're actually playing a role in the process all the time, I think that will lead to the solutions of the information overload.
Excellent. Okay, so engaging people, the platforms, the technologies, the role of government versus civil society. What do you think?
Well, in terms of, to respond to your first question is, you know, who should be the one kind of assimilating this data and digesting it for us? I mean, I would be the first to say that I don't think it should be the government for a host of reasons. Number one, I don't know they'd be the most accurate to do it. I think you would see it obviously being very much based on political power, partisanship, a whole host of other issues. Secondly, I'm not particularly confident they could do it accurately or with a level of competence that would allow the public to even access the information. I think ultimately it is up to the public. I think some of the organizations that are kind of interpreting data for us are some of the most closed off. I think there's an absolute role for the public universities to be open and transparent. You know, what are their motivations? In the news media, very closed off. I mean, what are the motivation, not just of the news organization itself, but the individual reporters that are reporting on this? You know, what are their motivations? What are their backgrounds? That's not listed as being relevant to the column that they're writing or the blog post, when clearly I think it's pretty obvious that the news media has gotten more partisan or more biased. A single blogger now can reach out to large groups of people. What are their motivations and interests? So I think in terms of having a completely enlightened and engaged society, those things would be incredibly important to do, because at its fundamental core, there's just always going to be a limit to what government can do. Government discloses their votes. All our votes are public. All campaign financing, contributions are public. There's lengthy, you know, ridiculous level of detail that has to go in these reports, and they're all public. I don't know how many people really go down to the city clerk's office and look up the reports, but they could. So at some level, the information is out there, and it's ultimately going to be up to individual people to do that. And it is a struggle. It's harder than ever now when it's so difficult. You know, all the issues that you've raised and that people just in the general public have to deal with on a daily basis, it's not easy. But I do think a lot of that information is out there.
Excellent.
You asked the question, is technology the answer? And I would say no. Technology is never the answer. Technology is only the answer if the question is, where do I want to go for lunch today in San Diego, or, you know, what's my high school buddy doing who lives in Boston right now? We are awash in information, and government generates an enormous amount of information at every level. So the challenge is synthesizing the data into something that makes sense and into something that people can discern some patterns in, which then enables them to comment on it. You also asked about the media. I think the state of the media now is a big problem. There are very, very, very few full-time working environmental reporters left in California, or any reporters.
Or political reporters.
So when I get interviewed on television, which happens, you know, infrequently, but it happens, they typically, you know, if I'm lucky, they'll come in clutching a newspaper story, and if I'm not lucky, they'll say, so what should I ask you about? And I'm married to an ex-journalist, so having a reporter ask me what they should ask me is kind of a shocking, disheartening occurrence. And on the lack of reporters who have real subject matter expertise, in my case, in things environmental, it's a huge problem. Because they don't have the sort of the intellectual context really to understand, why we do some of the things that we do, or to even, you know what are the good questions that I should be asking this person. I don't know what we do about it, but I think it's a huge problem, and I think the lack of, in particular the decline in coverage in Sacramento, which has occurred in the course of my career, basically in California politics, it's terribly distressing.
I would say that it's not just in Sacramento. If you pick up your sports page, it's terribly thin. If you pick up the local government page, sometimes that's a little better because there's more local contributors. But I think if we're going to talk about transparency, something very important. I think the media has totally collapsed. The news coverage has totally collapsed, and there's a real lack of accountability on what the truth is. And we all sort of trade on truths, and we give people enormous passes and great latitude to voice their perception of the truth. And I think if we have institutions that are going to help us, universities, the campuses, what we should be doing is training a new class of folks to come and help us with truth. and help us with the accountability that truth brings. And I think, look at the climate discussions. We still, in great swatches of government, can't talk about climate change. We, you know, it's global warming, it's this, it's that. It's there's always some political incorrectness when you're around that subject matter. And so there's no real honest truth. More than two-thirds of the states are doing nothing to prepare. Like it or not, climate change is happening. Like it or not, whether it's man, whether it's the stars, whether whatever's happening, it's happening. And we're not preparing because it's politically incorrect. And that's because people are untruthful in the media. And I think where the institutions really should be helping us is not dumbing ourselves down to 140 characters. And I don't mean to take a shot at BizStone and Twitter, but I get, you know, we need to expand our thoughts. We spend a lot of time with information. We have a lot of access to information every day. This is probably the longest I haven't looked at my, you know, my information device in some time, because I'm sitting right in this. But so I would say, you know, so we have access to a lot of information, but again, the quality of that information and who's writing it. You referred to a blogger. Who is a blogger but somebody that can type and expound their, you know, and if they're effective at it, they happen to be the loudest as opposed to the most accurate or truthful. And I think that our institutions are failing us there, is that we've lost track of really getting to the root of it. Your research is truth. Your, you know, what you do here is truth, and we need to disseminate that better.
That's fantastic. I was asked once by a reporter if we are in the business at universities of cultivating democratic citizens. You know, universities are charged all the time with political correctness, and that we're filling that category with too much content. But it seems to me that cultivating democratic citizens means cultivating citizens capable of critical scrutiny and learning how to be curious about the information that's handed to them. So developing those analytical skills seems to be the most important element of democratic citizenship on campuses. Let's continue. The platforms, the strategies. If you can recall particularly creative strategies that you've come across in your career of making accessibility more real for citizens.
Anyway. Well, all of us in politics, I think most of us, we have our email newsletters, we have our websites, we have our Facebook pages now. It took the Senate a long time to say institutionally that Facebook was an okay thing. So we have a lot of opportunities for young people, to be able to interface with us. But as I'm listening to all this, and I agree with most of it, that the modern media has collapsed. The young generation doesn't read newspapers. The levels of civic education are diminished. You know, when all else fails, I always go back to what can we do better with the next generation? And a few things come to mind. Number one, we must enhance and increase both civics education in middle and high schools. And we must change secondary school curriculum to make it more applied and experiential, including pathways in and around government and politics. Because unless young people get that spark, the same spark that I got one point in my life, that Brian got, that others got, to say, I choose to get involved, unless we expose them to things that give them that spark, we're not going to create those citizens who keep up and who get engaged and who get involved. And that's where we have to start. And I would add to that the love of reading, as basic as that sounds and seems, because I see it. Those young people who love to read, read more, and they read more diverse materials, and they deliberately expose themselves to a variety of opinions. But without that love of reading, you're stuck with television and the partisan crap on both sides. And it's the written word. It's that reading. that allows you to expose yourself to stories, to history, and to different opinions and make up your own mind.
That's great.
And I was glad that Brian mentioned earlier that it's not the government's responsibility, because I think a lot of us probably agree with that. And you know, the whole point of having the freedom of the press from the foundation of the country was so that there would be a tool out there to hold the government accountable. And then to answer the point about technology, technology is good and it's bad. And it has its positives and its negatives. For example, as Daryl mentioned, we all use technology in our newsletters. I put out a weekly video series that I call Are You Kidding Me?, where I take a minute and a half on a video and kind of explain or share with the voters in my district and across the state what I think is present what's happening in Sacramento, what I think is wrong about it, and what I would propose to fix it. And I try to do that in a minute and a half. But we can also argue that there's a downside to technology. For example, we're overexposed this week, I think, to the Ebola situation in Texas. Brian mentioned that we have a very competitive congressional race right here in the middle of San Diego. And I would propose that most voters in that district know more about the Ebola breakout in Texas that's really impacting two or three people at this point in time, maybe 20 people, where last year in America over 50,000 people died of the flu, than they do know about their own two candidates that are running to represent them in the U.S. Congress, the most powerful deliberative body in the world. And as Brian also mentioned, the national parties are coming in and inundating us with messages that have nothing to do with how those two candidates are going to represent us in Congress. And so as individuals, we have our own responsibility to try to break through the messaging and decipher for ourselves and our families what message is important, what do I need to pay attention to, and what do I need not pay attention to. And for myself personally, Facebook, I'm trying to wean myself off of, you know, spending non-productive time on Facebook as much as I can and get back to reading, because I think reading is a very good way to spend our time.
My son came home, he's 8 years old, he came home the other day, and in his social studies class, they did a kind of rough analysis on how many trees would be saved if one day of the New York Times was not printed. And I just cringed.
No,
that's not the way to teach. Anyway.
Would I be able to add something real quick?
Yes, yes.
It's approximately 50 acres. Just
that's right.
I really like what was mentioned about expanding the knowledge and the information that we have access to rather than shortening. Yeah. Making it digestible. And thinking about in school, I can think off the top of my head of a few subjects that I had repeated to me throughout the years of material that I learned over and over again, where there's not more flexibility in our educational system. And just yesterday on my ride home on the bus, someone asked me, "Oh, what class are you reading that for?" And I said, "I'm not reading that for a class." So that's kind of the culture around education, is that everything is mandated. You have to read what is required of you rather than learning for the sake of being a critical thinker.
Yes, no,
that's a really good point. I like that point. That's good.
Yeah. No. Don't
do your homework.
Don't do your homework.
That's a good point. Right advice.
Now that he's not Senate leader anymore, he's...
He can say things,
saying, don't
like
do your
that.
Homework.
Don't worry, Chancellor, I do my homework.
Go to school. Daryl unzipped.
So on this question of creating really a new citizen culture among our young people and how to do that, Daryl raised the issue of more experiential ways of understanding our communities, becoming less insular in the way we move through our lives. Something we're trying to do here at UC San Diego is to preserve the experiential dimension of learning at a time when class sizes are getting bigger, right? When students are more and more coming in, having prepared for the test without the kind of expansive engagement with real world issues that we would hope they would cultivate while they're here on the campus. And I should just say, it's really very wonderful. We've just received a grant from the Blum Center for Developing Economies at Berkeley, which is an entity there funded by UC Regent Richard Blum, to focus here at UC San Diego on putting our students into the local communities. It's an internship program. It's now called the Blum Cross-Border Initiative here at UCSD. And we're developing internships with community groups and governments in the region, so students actually have firsthand experience of what it means to sit inside of a council meeting, what it means to sit inside the boardroom of one of our nonprofits in the region. So they have more of a tangible sense of what's invested in that kind of activity. But on this question of citizenship culture, so in other words, making use of information that's available, whether it's overloaded or no matter what sort of platform it's presented to us on, obviously, you know, if we can't figure out how to translate what we know into mechanisms of accountability, whether it's in terms of process or product, then transparency really has no teeth. It doesn't mean anything. So what strategies of civic engagement are necessary to help translate public knowledge into meaningful democratic participation? Communities seem to need incentives to get involved. They need to see that there's somehow some purchase in investing time and resources in educating themselves. So in other words, if transparency is only about creating institutions that enable us to hold our leaders accountable, it's really half the story. We also have to consider the participatory practices that breathe life into democratic accountability. So can we maybe turn toward participatory practices here, and maybe some of the work that you've done in participating in them?
I have to say, I grew up in Northern New England, and in Northern New England, town hall meeting is something everybody goes to. Town hall meeting, where I grew up, there literally was a blackboard, and when we were voting on a new bus, they did the math, and it was how much per thousand it was going to cost everybody. And that direct democracy, people voted. People voted at town hall meeting, and it made a change. It really was, it's what invigorated me to get involved and to participate, and I think that we have to find ways either to reinvigorate those types of opportunities or invent new ones, right? Because life has changed. Doing things on a blackboard is not practical when we're talking about a $40 billion deficit and you've got to explain it in 12 hours, in order to get it passed. But again, there's got to be some bridge there. And that's another place where the institutions that we have, our universities and our schools, can help bridge that. But again, it's something that we have to, I really think it's getting back to the basics of participation. And that eliminates any sense of, oh, there's something strange, there's something secretive going on. If you're there at town hall, you hear, you see. I'm not getting it from Fox and Friends. I'm not getting it from MSNBC. I'm seeing it and I'm feeling it. It's a big difference. And you participate, it changes things.
I was, thinking about how to enhance participation. There are sort of two categories that come to mind. One is that I think we always need to be about breaking down the size and scale of the problem and of government so people feel that they are having an impact. I've noted over the last 20 plus years what's going on in local communities in Sacramento, and I know throughout the state, around the neighborhood movement. There are more neighborhood associations focused on the quality of the public park, the quality of the public schools, forming neighborhood watches. And it's been interesting to see this evolve because over the 20 years, the people who have led these movements started with these, I won't say small because they're important issues, but these smaller issues that directly affect their neighborhoods. But now they're the same people that are either choosing to run for school board or city council, or hosting coffees, or engaging more directly in electoral politics. But they've experienced their own power by virtue of seeing some indices of the quality of life in their own neighborhood improve as a result of their direct personal effort. The second category for me that has potential for increasing democracy is what I call cause politics. I've noted over the last number of years what's happened with the issue of autism and related disorders in California, and I've been involved legislatively in helping to lead that effort. And the reason we've been successful is because there is now a strong group of middle-class parents whose kids have been affected by autism who have come together to become their own political force demanding action. So whether it's breaking down the size of the problem and empowering people to get engaged in their own community, or encouraging people to take on a cause that is either directly relevant to their lives or something they feel strongly about. And by the way, it ought to be a cause that few others are working on, because people like the idea of breathing new life into something. Those are two ways, I think, to enhance participation. And then that leads to voter participation. Then that leads to people feeling like they have a stake.
Thank you.
I want to make sort of two comments. I mean, part of the participation question, I still find somewhat mysterious. You know, you don't know. My mother is 85 years old, and she lives in New York City in an apartment about the size of this stage. And when the last New York City mayor's race was happening, I said, "So who are you voting for?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know. I'm not following it. I can't stand any of them. It's all, you know, it's all kind of noise." And I said, "But you are going to vote." And she said, "Of course. It's my duty to vote." And that was the household that I was raised in, right? But I wonder where that comes from. That even though she didn't really like any of the candidates and she was kind of vaguely disgusted by all of it, you know, she was going to, you know, hobble to the polls, probably with, you know, somebody holding her arm and cast her vote, because she just felt like, yeah, I live here, I should vote. My other comment is in terms of California politics. I think that our Senate and Assembly districts are too large. I think we actually should have more smaller districts. You represent more people than most congressmen, than all congressmen do, really. Yeah, and which is, I live in Oakland, California, which is a small enough place that, you know, I actually know my city councilor, and we can have the 15 people running for mayor, you know, over to the House for a House meeting. But I think that it would solve a number of problems. It would make elections less costly, for one thing, if the districts were smaller. It does mean that there would be more politicians, which is doesn't sell very well, I think, to the, you know, to the general public. But I think it's a real issue.
I'd really like both your comments. In terms of, you know, you speaking of your mother, I do think there's this notion that a lot of people have that just voting is good, right? We should vote. But probably the reality is we should know what we're voting on before we vote. And I think if you don't, it makes you more susceptible to these types of poundings that, you know, the political parties have done, or these kind of character assassinations and all that, which in a sense makes it more difficult. In terms of the second comment, I don't know. I think, you know, having, you know, Daryl and a compatriot represent that same district, I don't know that, he's done a good job representing his district, so I don't mean to say him, but you end up with two elected officials, and I'm not sure that two are better than one. I think the best thing to do is have one good one, and they could represent a million people, half a million people, any of that. I do want to, in terms of civic engagement, I do want to give a shout out to Dean Ferrello, who's here at USD. One of the questions you, the dean of USD Law School, one of the things you talked about having public education or having educational institutes have a commitment to educating civically, having a civic education for their students. You know, Dean Ferrello came in and he really made a commitment of having people, I happen to teach there, and he made a commitment to say, we want to have people who've been out in the real world, who've been engaging in these real issues, talk about subjects that they have a level of expertise in. So the students have an opportunity, whether it's an elected official, whether it's a judge, across the spectrum, let them talk to people, let them see people, let them be taught to people by people who are intimately involved in our civic society. And I think it takes a commitment from the leadership. He's done a great job at USD of doing that. And I think the students really get a value out of that because they see people that are having an impact, that are working on this day in and day out, actually in the real world doing it. And I think that is an area where it gets people wanting to, you know, get off their iPhones and iPads and all that and want to read. I love him saying that. I love that part of it, the not do your homework part, is you just cutting loose now that you have less responsibility, but the rest of it's spot on.
It slipped.
So an interesting set of questions, sort of. So on the question of participatory process, you know, one of the reasons it seems that people disengage is because, as it was mentioned, they don't see any potential of actually influencing political decisions, that they won't actually have an impact on the process or the results of it.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
You know, this whole conversation about the participation rate is nothing new. I mean, there's studies done that during the Revolutionary War, when the colonies were deciding whether to secede from England or not, it was 3% of the population that was carrying that message, and it was 3% of the population that was animated and determined to make that happen. And then they, you know, through the technology of that day, were able to convince a majority of the rest of the colonists to come along with them. So it's always a small portion of the population that begins to lead the change.
Yes, point taken, absolutely. But what I'd like, obviously, the political demographics have become more diverse and complex since then. Here's my question. It's the question of responsiveness. So in discussions of transparency, we talk about what the government needs to do to make information available for people to actually use it. But the other end, then, how do these new technologies and these new platforms then enable governments to become more responsive to citizens who are now empowered with new information and new strategies of civic engagement? How does the government become more responsive to a more educated public?
Well, it's a pretty basic principle: the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Mm-hmm. And that in a representative government such as ours, the more involved the citizenry is in engaging with their elected officials, with their representatives, the more responsive as a representative I'm going to be. So, for example, in my district, I have a diverse socioeconomic group of people. I've got a diverse political backgrounds. So my job is to be responsive to all of those citizen groups and balance the conflicting desires. If the groups conflict in what they want their government to do, then I have to balance in my decision making based on their input. And I think that's true for all of us. Is, you know, when we're in committee in the Capitol building, who's testifying, who's taking the time to come to the committee hearing and testify in committee, who's taking the time today when we come off the platform today? Are you just going to let us leave, or are you going to engage us in a conversation and you know, beyond what's just being presented? And you know, it's all, those are all steps that...
Let me just clarify. Obviously, you know, politicians have incentives, you know, to be responsive to constituencies. We know this. But I'm trying to think about new ways that governments can respond to newly engaged demographics to actually help publics understand that their voice, their activity, their participation has an influence on what... Not just where the votes are, right? Not where the votes are, but where the needs are. where, you know, where democratic agency is emerging maybe in new sectors of our society.
The one technology that has made a difference in our work and that I think makes it easier to illustrate our work and also makes it easier for the general public to engage in what we do are geographic information systems, mapping, essentially electronic mapping. Because rather than talking about the fact that this acquisition will create a wildlife corridor from point A to point B, I can show it on a map. And in the marine life protection process, people, citizens involved, could play with the maps. And if you're interested in habitat and endangered species, once you've got a base map of where things are, you can draw the polygons and you can see which places give you the protection that you say that you want for this or for that. And it's also made it easier just for us internally in terms of our planning. And, you know, there are sort of open public mapping tools and platforms that people can use and that communities can use to help, you know, plan their land use future. And I think that you still have to want to be involved, and it's, you know, it's kind of wonky. But I think that is something that I've seen that makes a difference in terms of bringing people into the discussion.
We have to talk, I think, about an elephant in the room here that is a counterforce to all of the good things we have talked about here. And that is the United States Supreme Court's view of what constitutes free speech as it relates to politics and money in politics. Because the members that I've worked with the exception of a couple, are honest people. They want to do the very best that they can. But writ large for this system that we have, there is no question that money, and what do I mean by money? It's many things. It's not just the contributions one receives for running for office or running for re-election. It's the fear that if you cross a special interest, the next time you run, and especially if you want to run for a higher office, that special interest will, without limitation, be able to spend millions of dollars in so-called independent expenditure committee to be able to twist your record, to be able to defeat you in ways that, yes, turn off the public, but at the same time are proven to be effective when it comes to elections. That needs to be said at least once in this 90-minute session, that is a problem. It is a problem that makes all of the other organizing tools, empowerment tools, and technology even more relevant and important, but less effective when contrasted with the way people are barraged with these ads during election season. And I don't know what we do about it, because I have gone from being a guy who believes in contribution limits and all the good government stuff, I voted for every one of them, to now believe that they're pretty meaningless. Because you can restrict contributions to a candidate, but that's not going to stop XYZ coalition of either business, labor, you pick your side, doesn't matter, from being able to spend those millions of dollars independently to influence an election. And unless and until we have a new set of Supreme Court justices who are going to see the insidious nature of too much money in politics and overturn Citizens United and or Buckley v. Vallejo, this conversation is always going to be important, compelling, and relevant, but it's going to be less impactful than it otherwise might be.
I just need to say something as well. With very few exceptions, everybody that gets elected to the state legislature could make a hell of a lot more money doing something else.
So could professors. But.
And not, and well,
so could
I will tell you that a lot of professors make a lot more than our legislators. And I will say this, that until the culture of tearing these guys apart changes somewhat and we get back to what I said in the beginning, which is truth, we're going to constantly get folks that either are, you know, putting themselves up for, you know, annihilation, character annihilation at any given time. And we're not going to attract more of the best and the brightest. And so it truly is public service, what these guys do. I see it day in and day out. It's not easy work. And again, we do horrible at defending them and defending our guys. We vote for them. We should help protect them by shielding them from the dishonesty, which money corrupts does. Money brings it in. The idea that, you know, some people are spending $100 million this year, personal. One person can spend $100 million in this system and drown out any good words that one of these guys could say is just, it's mind-boggling.
That's great. So now that things are getting fired up, I think it's the time to bring the audience into the conversation. So we have a little less than 15 minutes left. Can we have a microphone that can be? Here we go. That way the cameras can pick up. Yeah, can pick up. Okay, so please.
So one of my questions, or it's a comment, in the world that I live in, which is high-tech product development, the sequence is priorities and then choices. You draw a line and you do that. And then you get into execution. And a lot of the transparency that's been talked about in technology, sure, that'll give, you know, get all the 10,000-page bills posted to a website, but the behind the doors critical discussion of priorities, which is the budgeting process, that says we're going to do this and not do this because we don't have the money for it. That's where I think transparency is most important, and that's also would address the town hall why people can't engage, because nobody's got the time or gives a rat's caputi. About the process of the bill, it's more about is that bill, that agency worth doing the right priority?
Priorities. Would somebody like to take that?
I think it goes to Daryl's point earlier when he said the ends, you know, the process to get to the ends. Sometimes we do pay, the media pays more attention to the process because they're looking for the sensational quote from a committee hearing, or they're looking for a sensational quote from a public meeting like this, rather than report what was the final vote and how did your representative vote and what does that vote mean to you when the budget's passed and it impacts whatever industry you work in or whatever you know, part of government impacts your life. How does that – and I think that's – to your point, I think sometimes the final vote and the final impact is what we miss in the reporting.
But I'd like to – amend something I said earlier, or at least clarify it. 2009, the budget that I described really should be and is the exception to the rule. Because I agree with you that in normal circumstances, that transparency in terms of explaining the choices that legislators have to make, healthcare versus higher education, public safety versus tax credits, is really important, and the public scrutiny is very, very important to highlight those choices. And that's another area where I think the public can intelligently organize themselves around a particular budget issue and a particular choice. In the end, the product is what matters, but in general, the product is much better when it's informed by a lot of public input.
So just to that, when I was in grad school, my public administration budgeting professor started off the class by saying, budgets are what governments do. We have laws and we have regulations. We have, you know, rooms full of books about what we're supposed to do. But the budget as a document tells you what we actually do. And it gets much less scrutiny generally, and the budgeting process gets much less scrutiny than the law writing process does, which is, in my view, kind of too bad.
I have two questions. One is that PACs, money goes to PACs, and we're talking about transparency. And the PACs give money to either party, and we're not knowing who is putting the money into the PACs. Who are the big contributors or the small contributors putting this money in? And there's something going on right now with Congress. They're criticizing the president for not appointing a Kaiser. But yet, the Senate is holding up the election of a Surgeon General. And they're not saying why they're holding it up. It's all because of his opinion on the National Rifle Association against the Surgeon General, which the president has recommended. And so when you hear a politician get up there, why isn't the president doing something, be it whatever party, if it was George Bush or this particular president now, that they're criticizing him for not doing something, but on the other hand, they're holding back on allowing the president to appoint somebody. And I don't, you know, I find something wrong there in the transparency.
If I can address the PAC question, I think in the, at the state level, for state PACs, most of that information is available on who supports them. And certainly where the PAC spends their money, that's public information. And right now we're in the 24-hour reporting period. If a PAC contributes over $1,000 to any candidate, that's on the internet within 24 hours, so we can know that. Now, PACs are an interesting tool that, you know, for the most part are used by professional associations and corporations. But any individual can start a PAC. So if you've got a concerned group in your homeowners association of a particular issue, you can start a PAC and say, hey, I'm going to collect money and we're going to use it for this purpose to support candidates that support our issue, whatever your issue is, or you can just host a fundraiser at your home for the local candidate who you think best represents your principles and what's important to you. So there are legitimate criticism against PACs, but they also are a legitimate tool that everyday citizens can use.
I want to say this. Independent expenditures, we don't know who's put the money in until after the election, and they're the ones that are spending mind-boggling amounts of money in the process, putting ads up, attack ads. Again, we don't know who's putting the money in, where it's coming from, until long after it's over and the decisions have been made. It's a very corrupting and it's eroding our process. And we just, and again, it goes back to Citizens United. And every time we do a little reform on finance reform, you know, that it's like a jelly donut. You just press it one spot, it pops out another. And you've got to, I don't have an answer for it, but I'm going to tell you, the independent expenditures are very dangerous. It's a big problem. In our state, it's a big problem nationwide.
Okay. I have the microphone back here. I believe the state of Oregon has mandatory mail-in voting for the entire state, if I'm not mistaken. And it's probably more cost-effective, too. What would you think of going total mail-in ballots in California?
I think we probably will get there at some point. But I like what we have today. I think, you know, there's no longer an election day in California. When you really stop and think about it, it's really election month. From the time the vote-by-mail ballots are eligible to be turned in to Election Day. And then, of course, all sorts of counting that goes on after Election Day, especially in close elections. And there are a lot of people now that like the convenience of vote by mail. But there are still the traditionalists who like trudging to the voting booth. I do, too. I love the it's a big deal to go there and do that. And take my kids, and this is meaningful to me. I think it's meaningful to a lot of people. So I like the combination. But in fact, we're moving quite a bit towards the vote-by-mail approach.
I don't know that it's better. I think, you know, in Afghanistan, where they have the Taliban and they have people, you know, lives are in danger. They do the purple finger. They dip their finger in ink that's indelible, and they walk around. And they're marked, truly marked, for a great deal of time, puts them in danger. But they all participate. The turnout in Afghanistan is amazing because they want to effectuate change. I think going to the polls is something that we should make it easier. We should get, like, they should be open longer. I think it's very effective to make it so it's not just a 12-hour, 8-hour period, whatever it is. But I think that going, the ceremony of going and participating, it's meaningful. And again, it's participation. And again, I understand the expedience of trying to cut costs and do other things. But again, all these things that we've done to cut costs hasn't brought more people into the fold. Voter participation is dropping. So I think maybe going back to some of the things that we did traditionally might be, you know, not everything has to be reinvented.
Do you think voter registration rules can be changed, can be improved?
They are being changed. I mean, as we speak, we did 24-hour, or we did online registration in 2012. We're working towards 24-hour, like Brian was saying, 24-hour registration. So that's all in process now, I think.
Yeah, simplifying the voter registration process is a really big thing that can have a lot of change, because when you talk to students who've probably never voted before and you try to get them to register to vote, you say, oh, you need your driver's license, you need your new address and where you were born. And so it's a lot of, it's like paperwork, and students don't really have that. It's not fun, right? Registering to vote isn't fun, so making that process simpler will have a big effect. And recently I filled out my mail-in ballot and realized I didn't have any stamps, so I still am holding on to that. So that's another concept, right?
Anybody have a stamp out there?
Yeah.
Anybody?
Just one stamp. Okay, I'll get one.
Right over here. Thank you.
Oh, hi. My name is Jeff Fadig. I'm a graduate student in the International Relations program here. First, I just want to thank you, Senator Steinberg, for your work to help keep the Kings. It was a really proud day for the city when we found out the team was staying, so thanks a lot for that.
Downtown's a mess right now up in Sacramento, but it'll get better, I'm sure.
It's coming. Yeah, come up in a few years. I think you'll be impressed. But what I wanted to ask kind of the panel was your thoughts on the initiative process, because I feel that that's kind of the nexus between, you know, it was originally passed because of citizen accountability, but then it's also kind of fallen victim to these issues that you've brought up with information overload, big money, where people, if they have enough money, they can get their own pet project on the ballot. And at the same time, the media has really dumbed it down to where people don't have a very accurate idea of what these propositions do. So now, you know, you have people, if they, you know, they think they spend $7 billion and it's going to start raining with this water bond that we have. So that's just an example. But I just kind of like to hear if you think that that's something that should be reformed, or if it's helping democracy in our state now.
Can I just take this only because I just passed a major bill in this area? You know, to recognize when it comes to the initiative process, people complain about it. They hate it, but don't you dare touch it, you policymakers. I mean, that's really sort of the way it is. They want to keep it intact. But what's happened is there are two different power centers now. You have what some call the initiative industrial complex, and you've got representative government. And the two go on separate universes here, and in the end, they often collide, and that's not a good thing. So I passed a bill this year that was the product of bipartisan support and a number of stakeholders that did a number of things, but most significantly brought back what's called the indirect initiative. Now when an initiative proponent submits their signatures, usually in January or February of the election year, it's a decision that cannot be turned back. If those signatures are valid, that measure goes on the ballot. Whether or not in the intervening 9 or 10 months, the initiative proponent believes that the legislature has addressed the problem, or they desire for whatever reason not to go forward. My bill, SB, I think it was 1285, signed by the governor just a couple of weeks ago, allows an initiative proponent to withdraw their signatures much closer to the actual election. And why that is significant is because once the legislature and a governor knows that there is a threat of a real initiative, they can get together with the proponent, or not get together with the proponent, but try to solve the problem legislatively. If the proponent believes the problem has not been dealt with satisfactorily, they can withdraw their signatures much later. That will avoid some of the worst initiatives going through, but most importantly will allow these two power centers to find a way to work together in a way that often, more often than not, I believe will lead to a better result.
We have just less than a minute left, but I'd like you to at least be able to offer your question.
I'll direct it at Assemblymember Jones because he brought up the history. And so, you know, almost 250 years since George Washington gave his farewell warning about the dangers of factions in our political process. I mean, one thing I think we see here today is we have representatives from both parties, and we see that we're actually more agreeable than our politics would suggest. So
the media would suggest.
Would the media and, you know, the campaigns, look at the Peters and DeMaio race. It's the political parties dumping in hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to create this divisive debate. So I would say in a world where, you know, young people are in large numbers, over 60% registering as non-affiliated with either party, at what point is it those representatives who are in power, in part because they put a registration of a political party by their name, do they have the obligation to say to young voters, you know what, you don't have to be a part of the divisive atmosphere to participate in the process?
That's a fantastic way to punctuate this panel and to invite everybody back to the civility panel this afternoon. So thank you so much. That was a perfect ending. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.